We'll call the meeting of the Agriculture and Rural Development Committee to order January 25th, 2005, 2:30 p.m. Members, what we'll be doing for the next 2 days is you can see we've got quite an aggressive agenda. And normally when we're discussing bills, debating issues, amendments, we do not cut off debate. That's not something I like to do. But I would request the committee members that for the next 2 days, so that we can hear what these various associations, commodity groups have to say, I would like to spend most of our time listening to them. And for the people that are on the agenda for today, several very important things: who you are, who you represent, what your legislative agenda is for the group you represent, and why you should exist. Okay, with that, we will start with, we have a quorum. We will officially call a meeting to order the House Ag Committee, and we will start out with Mr. Tom Peterson from the Minnesota Farmers Union, and we are going to actually be timing folks. You'll have up to 10 minutes, and members, get down their name. You got their names, get down their phone numbers and addresses. If you have handouts, we'll have the page hand those materials out. But we will limit your questions. We do want you to contact these people if you have some questions about what they're doing and who they're representing and so forth. Okay, Representative Welty moves the minutes from Wednesday, January 19th, 2005. Any additions or corrections to the minutes? Hearing none. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are passed. Thank you, Representative Welty. Okay, Mr. Tom Peterson, if you could please state your name, who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Tom Peterson. I'm Director of Government Relations with the Minnesota Farmers Union. And I think that hopefully most people are familiar that Minnesota Farmers Union is a general farm organization that has been around in Minnesota since 1929. We have members in all counties of the state, and we have active county units in over 70 counties. And many of those counties have multiple local units that are active as well. I just would like to run through some of our issues for the upcoming year, and I appreciate the opportunity to do that. Our first issue this year is, because it's a budget year, the main issue we have looked at is the ag budget and ag share of the budget. And being less than 1/3 of 1% concerns us. My environmental friends have a slogan they're using: give 2 cents for the environment, or 2% for the environment. I have to come up with something that catchy for agriculture, you know, give 0.3% for agriculture. But we're very concerned about, you know, not the joking, is how small that share of the budget has gotten when agriculture is so important. And it's good to see that we'll see later today that the governor's budget will reflect that commitment to agriculture. So we support continuing the ethanol producer payments, EURI, funding for that, funding for organic and sustainable programs, growing at a 20% rate in the state. I just visited the Wedge Co-op last week. They have 11,000 members, and they can't keep enough grass-fed beef. And the suppliers tell me that that's a tremendous opportunity for independent producers. County fair grants is something else that I think is very important, and glad to see that will be in the governor's budget. And then dairy. The Minnesota Dairy Initiative, dairy development teams, very important, but also room for a lot of opportunity, I see. I just had an opportunity this last weekend to visit with a farmer, Mr. Haugen, from down in Representative David's district, who actually works for Wisconsin Extension. And part of his main job is to upgrade dairy facilities. And I was really excited. I drove all the way down to Canton to see where he farms. And he upgrades dairy facilities, and he's doing it in Wisconsin. But the good thing is, when he upgrades a dairy barn, they keep their cattle, they expand, they add more cows, and they're still farming. So I think there's things there we can look at. He also told me that he just did the La Crosse Dairy Show this weekend. And he said that people that came to the Wisconsin Extension booth to sign up for this information on retrofitting their barns, out of the 60 producers, 40 of them were from Minnesota. So we got to figure out how we can help those people. We also favor local control for township issues when it comes to livestock siting. And we do think there are things that could be done in the process of siting. As far as changing anything with that, we oppose that. An important issue for us is life estates and changes made 2 years ago that allow for liens on life estates. and we talk about livestock, I'm very concerned about this. I think that every day when people know that I'm working on this issue, they call me and say, what's going on with this? And they're livestock producers a lot of times. And very concerned about how farms are. A lot of times the wealth is in the land, and that you don't get a chance a lot of times to build up. And when it comes time to pass the farm, life estates, right or wrong, has been a very effective tool for nearly 40 years in helping to pass that farm for the next generation. Dairy, we support the dairy investment tax credit that you've heard a lot about, and I'm pleased to see that that will be in the governor's budget. And also we support the idea of a beginning producer payment of some kind, and hear that bill in the Senate tomorrow. I've been really interested. I've been quoted a few times lately in a couple of papers. I was in the St. Cloud paper yesterday, and I've gotten three phone calls in the last 2 days from dairy farmers who are looking to get back into dairy farming, wondering how this will work, and very excited about it and interested in it. So I hope that some of those ideas go forward. I also sit on the G16 group that you've heard. Representative Osmond, he's not sitting here today, so but he can tell you that I've been on this impaired waters task force for 2 years, it seems like 10 years, in addressing this issue. But we do feel that the policy part of the issue is good. And that it does, myself and Chris Raddatz from Farm Bureau and the Minnesota Department of Ag have worked on making sure that agriculture is well represented in this bill that you'll see at some point. The funding solution is a tough one, and I think I visited with many of you about that. We do support going forward with the fee that's been proposed, although Farmers Union would support and did think originally it should be a general fund solution. We support CREP and the bonding for CREP and the RFA, and think that's important and hope that that moves forward. And we support ethanol and the 20%, and commend the chairman for the bill that we'll be hopefully seeing soon and hearing next week. And Farmers Union, it's always interesting. This weekend we had a board meeting, and I'm always surprised at how many farmers have shares in the ethanol plants and are very proud of the investment and the chance that they took, and that's a real positive thing for Minnesota. I don't have any answers for this, but in Representative Magnus's district and Representative Peterson's district, we see more farmers talking to us about transmission issues for wind energy. I'm working on a bill to see if how we can address when we have wind towers going in. We support wind energy. We have many members that are involved in that. But then when the transmission lines are going through private property, there's some issues there that will need to be addressed. Last quick issues are the farmer lender mediation bill that is very important. It sunsets this year, and Representative Pennis has a bill that many of you have signed on to and appreciate. I think it's very important that helps our family producers, and I hope that that bill goes forward also. And then the last thing I want to just to mention too that I think is important is that Farmers Union also supports a gas tax, and we're always concerned about Brazil and what Brazil's doing in soybeans and growth, and our president just got back from Brazil, and he said the one place where we beat them big time is on transportation costs, and we need to continue to be a leader there. So I hope that you all consider that. Those are my remarks, and I'll be glad to answer any questions when the time arises. So,
just quickly point out, I hope every farmer in this room supports the gas tax, Mr. Chair, because farmers don't pay the gas tax.
Mr. Chair, thank
you. Okay.
Field equipment, really?
Let's go through the chair. Such controversy. Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Peterson. Darren McBeth, Minnesota Agri-Growth Council, if you could please join us. And again, members, today is to find out what these different associations, commodity groups are thinking, what their legislative agendas are, and contact information on how to get a hold of folks. Mr. McBeth, welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Darren McBeth. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Agri-Growth Council. It's a pleasure to be here with you in the committee today. Also seated with me is Mr. Corey Bennett, who many of you know with Capitol Hill Associates and is the lobbyist for the council. Some of you also may know we're delighted, the Agri-Growth Council is delighted to have Corey and Capitol Hill Associates on board. And Corey has a distinguished service record of working in the Senate with the Senate Ag Committee for an 8 to 10 year period. So we look forward to both of us to working with you. for some of you who are new to the committee or to even agriculture issues, it's my pleasure to tell you a little bit about the Agri-Growth Council. The Agri-Growth Council is a nonprofit trade association representing 160-plus of Minnesota's agribusinesses, food companies, academic institutions, and other associations. The council's been in existence since 1968, when it was started by, many of you may know, Earl B. Olson from Wilmer, who, of course, is the founder of the Genio Turkey Store, and we're proud to have him as one of our founders with the Agri-Growth Council. The mission of the Agri-Growth Council now is much as it was at its formation in 1968, to promote Minnesota's food and agriculture industry, including businesses engaged in taking commodities and adding value to them and processing them and getting them to the consumer's table nationwide. And Minnesota and even the Twin Cities area is proud to have many ag food processors that do take Minnesota commodities and Minnesota food products and get them nationwide and even internationally by adding value to them and processing them. The Minnesota Agri-Growth Council is also proud to facilitate the Minnesota Commodity Coalition, made up essentially of all of Minnesota's commodity organizations. The Commodity Coalition is currently chaired by Roger Gilland, an Agri-Growth Council board member who's also a beef producer from Morgan, Minnesota, and who's also active with the Minnesota State Cattlemen's Association. In the past years, the Commodity Coalition has circulated three-ring binders with positions of the commodity organizations to all members of the legislature, and also meets periodically throughout the year to make sure to keep communicating on ag issues among the commodity groups. Of course, the Agri-Growth Council, in primarily representing agribusinesses, is also proud to partner very closely with the producer and commodity organizations of the state, and that is a nice partnership between processors and producers. The committee is asked here today to highlight our legislative priorities, and so I'll give you an overview of six goals that the council is interested in for 2005. Number one, strengthening the state's animal agriculture sector, and all that that entails, including livestock production, processing, the manufacture of feed, meat, dairy, egg processing, and other segments related to the animal ag sector. You received an overview of some work that the Agri-Growth Council is responsible for with a study that the University of Minnesota compiled back when dairy was your subject last week. And that study that we put together in the University of Minnesota authored showed that $5.2 billion in direct economic impacts are directly related to the animal ag sector in Minnesota, nearly 100,000 jobs. And that study also reduced down to the livestock, each livestock species in economic value, showing that each dairy cow in the state generates $5,000 in economic activity per year, $2,000 per hog, $1,636 per beef cow, just over $11 per turkey, and over $2 per broiler. And don't let the $11 and $2 per broiler or turkey sound small, because there's 44 million each of those species in the state, so that adds up to a significant economic value. And I shouldn't leave out the horse and equine industry, which is also a valued part of animal agriculture, just because we don't eat them in this country. $6,000 a head that the equine industry generates in economic activity in the state. Secondly, Agri-Growth is seeking to promote value-added agriculture and ag processing, especially through the use of renewable energy, including ethanol, biodiesel, biomass, and wind energy. Thirdly, we will support and protect ag programs and services administered by the Department of Ag and the University of Minnesota, including the Board of Animal Health and the Veterinary Diagnostic Lab, for instance. And the preceding witness also indicated that I think there's some rosy, positive message coming out of the governor's budget with respect to funding for ag programs in the Department of Ag, in that at this time, from their budget, we expect there to be no cuts. So as opposed to past years, that's very positive. Fourth, we support the comprehensive impaired waters package put forward by the G16 group that did include ag representatives from the Farm Bureau and Farmers Union, as well as partnerships with business and environmental stakeholders. We feel that moving forward with the impaired waters package will effectively prevent continued moratoriums, in essence, of businesses and livestock facilities in areas that are in impaired water category. So we see that as positive, and also an opportunity for ag landowners and farmers to benefit from restoration funds and efforts on a voluntary basis to address impaired waters. Fifth, as I was mentioning, AgriGrow supports common sense agriculture conservation initiatives like state bonding for the CREP package brokered last year and other efforts to target sensitive and highly erodible lands rather than productive farmland. And lastly, sixth, as a general matter, AgriGrowth will be promoting policies that encourage biotechnology, appropriate access to crop protection products, and other technologies that balance consumer nutrition with health and safety of our food supply, and affordable production and processing of food. So with that quick statement, that's an overview of the AgriGrowth Council's priorities. We're governed by, I'll add, a board of 20 directors that are a cross-section of Minnesota's ag economy from the producer side and industry side. You know, we meet quarterly, and who they are is the public information available on our website, agrigrowth.org, and you're welcome to look there for other information, including our 04, 05 policy resolutions and so forth, and of course, Corey and I are always available to answer questions. So, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is AgriGrowth and the department planning another tour in the near future?
Thank you for asking that question, Ben. Mr. Chairman, Representative Junkie, members of the committee, one thing I forgot to mention was the AgriGrowth Council annually hosts an ag tour, and it's open to the public. We charge just enough to cover our costs. We get a couple throwaways buses, and really is aimed at legislators, although, as I said, it's open to the public. And we focus on a different area of the state and usually have somewhat of a different theme and directly to answer a question. We will certainly be doing a tour again this year around the first week of August. Last year we went through southeast Minnesota. This year we'll be looking to go west to southwest Minnesota. And it's an overnight trip. In the past it's been 2 nights, 3 days. We've shaved that down out of the interest of everybody's time to 2 days, 1 night. But I think it's a great educational opportunity for all of us, and I learn a lot on the tour as well, and of course Representative Junkie and asking the question attended last year, and some of you else, others did as well, so look for more information on that and please attend.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you and to other members, and especially to the chair. Hopefully we get an opportunity to go on that tour, and leadership will see fit to help us defray some of the costs. It was worthwhile. We were in your neck of the woods, I believe, last year, and definitely worthwhile, members. You see a lot of agriculture in 2 days, and you get to visit with a lot of agriculture people. It's good.
Thank you. Thank you. We'll be there. Okay, thank you very much, gentlemen. Next, we have Jerry Schoenfeld and Dave Priestler. And for members, if you want to correct Jerry Schoenfeld's name, the spelling of his name is S-C-H-O-E-N-F-E-L-D. I had a little trouble with that, but we'll make her through. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Schoenfeld and Mr. Priestler. If you want to state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And, Mr. Chairman, as some of you know, I have four or five groups that will be coming up here throughout the day that I work with. And the first thing I have to do is help manage this a little bit. And the first thing is that Mr. Priestler is not at the table. Mr. Priestler is sitting in the audience. And instead, we have Larry Leopold. Larry Leopold.
Okay.
President.
How do you spell the last name there?
Spelling is L-I-E-P-O-L-D.
Larry, okay. Thank you very much. Gentlemen.
With that, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Leopold. We do have, if we could have a page, please, we do have some priority sheets here for the sheriff legislators. So
yes, the page. Jennifer, if you want to grab the sheets there, please.
Well, Mr. Chairman, thank you for this opportunity to speak before the committee this morning, today. My name is Larry Leopold. I'm president of the Minnesota Pork Producers Association. And the MPPA is a voluntary organization, membership organization currently, which represents the 3,000 pork-producing families and their employees in Minnesota. My farms are near Okabena and Heron Lake in Jackson County. Generally, most pork producers in 2004 had a very good year. And this profitability was needed because 2002 and 2003 were not quite as sweet. The business of raising hogs continues to change just like other businesses evolve. Some have used this time of good prices to retire and exit pork production. Currently, the inventory is worth more in resale value or rental value of equipments and buildings that have been built is very, very good. Pork in general, by consumers, demand is good. both internationally and domestically. And we look forward to a profitable 2005 as well. And traditionally, pork producers have not asked for government subsidies. We are not currently subsidized, and the federal government does not provide pork producers a safety net. According to preliminary data, pork will continue to be the single largest commodity in Minnesota as measured by farm gate income. We're ahead of dairy, corn, beans, cattle, and all other commodities in the state. The handout that we've given you provides just an overview. The one side provides an overview of the economic contributions and the environmental contributions to the state. The other side we'll get to in a moment has also got our legislative priorities on it. Most of you, I hope, have seen the front page of Sunday Star Tribune business section on ethanol. Ethanol is truly a Minnesota success story. In fact, I'm a corn producer, corn and soybean producer, and a shareholder in a newly built plant, a plant that will be built a quarter mile from my home farm in near Heron Lake, Minnesota, Heron Lake Bioenergy. It'll be a coal-fired plant, and you'd think I'd have concerns being only a quarter mile away, but I'm very confident in what that plant's going to bring. I'm pro-ethanol, pro-biodiesel, also a shareholder in the Brewster plant and also the oil refinery at Brewster. And I applaud the corn and soybean growers for the legislative accomplishments they've had over the last few years. But let's put in perspective the comparative economic input. Pork production in Minnesota generates over three times the economic impact and four times the jobs as ethanol. It does this with no state or federal subsidy safety nets, job zone, or tax increment financing. And I say this to demonstrate how the livestock industry, and specifically pork production, is truly rural economic development. Okay, on the reverse side of that handout, it shows some priorities that we would like to direct ourselves towards in this session. Just briefly go through them. The first of the things we do, protecting our membership's ability to operate, and that prohibit non-farm homes and agriculturally zoned land. It's getting more and more person dense in the rural areas, and sooner or later, as homes build next to livestock facilities, conflict will develop. We'd like to inform livestock producers when someone else accesses their data. It's only fair to the producer that he be not necessarily forewarned, but know if there's disease developing in the area, if there's PRV has been taken care of, or high levels of PRRS, something is going on in the area, it's nice to know it. And also, just be more vigilant if someone is looking at the data with more than pure or with less than pure reasons. I'd like to hold local government accountable. Impaired water funding. MPPA supports the impaired waters proposal as long as that funding is equitable and the funding is using for projects on the ground and not building a greater bureaucracy. It's that simple. University research. I used to chair the research committee with the MPPA in years past. I found it very fascinating. Worked with the University of Minnesota very closely, enjoyed my time working with them. As a producer, there's a couple things that I like out of a veterinary diagnostic lab. I like quick, accurate information, and I like to know that there's people that stand behind that information can help me out when I need it, and they seem to be that way. We would encourage funding that at the University of Minnesota, and let's keep our work in state. Transportation, like it or not, it's a reality that agriculture is getting larger, be it grain or livestock, whatever it would be, and most of it is semi-tractor trailer based. Distance to markets and other issues require it to be that. And because of this, in the interest of safety, MPPA encourages upgrades to 10-ton capacity, upgrades of roads to 10-ton capacities. And finally, I'd like to protect rural funding of roads as well. Be it ever so brief, again, it's a pleasure to speak with you today. Thank you for your time. I'd be glad to answer any questions any of the committee has now or at any time. Thank you.
Okay, and thank you, sir, for the contact information here, and Mr. Schoenfeld, thank you for your presentation.
Very good.
Next, Ron Jacobson, Minnesota Soybean Growers Association. And if we could have the page pass out some information here.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Chairman David, and fellow members of the committee. My name is Ron Jacobson. I'm a soybean corn farmer near Wells, Minnesota, and I serve as president of the Minnesota Soybean Growers Association. Minnesota Soybean Growers Association is a nonprofit farmer-controlled member organization established in 1962. The goal is to assure profitable soybean farming by monitoring government policies and supporting research and market development activities. Minnesota has over 25,000 soybean producers. We grow over 7 million acres of Minnesota farmland, harvest over 275 million bushels of soybean annually, and the soybeans have a market value of $1.5 billion. As such, soybean farmers are an important part of Minnesota's economy. Our priorities: to expand the domestic market for soybeans, soybean meal, and soybean oil. To support the state's livestock industry. To show proactive leadership in critical research areas. To support international trade projects, monitor trade agreements, and encourage legislation that improves our standing in the world marketplace. And influence key infrastructure and transportation issues. Our domestic market. Minnesota soybean farmers are the biggest and best customers of the state livestock industry. Minnesota's livestock industry consumes 2.3 million tons of soybean meal annually, generate $30 billion of direct and indirect income, provide over 200,000 jobs. 95% or more of all soybeans processed in meal in this state goes to livestock production. But the livestock industry is under attack. Families who want to expand or modernize their farms are finding themselves in the middle of a costly controversy. Rather than encourage rural development and allow livestock producers to farm profitably in an environmentally friendly manner, others are creating delays, threatening lawsuits that have caused some farmers to either move their operations out of state or give up their plans altogether. This is an unfortunate trend that will further erode our rural economies. MSGA advocates are clear, concise, and reasonable regulations and processes that are science-based. Research. Research funding has never been more important as the soybean farmers face a new threat, soybean rust. Soybean rust is a fast-spreading fungal disease that causes yield losses from 50 to 90% in other areas of the world. This past fall, soybean rust had not until this past fall, soybean rust had not reached the United States. On November 10th, the USDA's Animal Plant Health Inspection Service announced that soybean rust was confirmed in Louisiana. Since then, rust has been confirmed in 8 additional states. This discovery of soybean rust in North America has significant implications for the nation's soybean industry. But the timing of the discovery was fortunate in that Minnesota's soybeans and other Midwestern states had already been harvested. Furthermore, the fungus that caused the soybean rust is not believed to be hardy enough to survive our winters. This gives us a small window of opportunity to fully prepare Minnesota soybean farmers for the next growing season. What is most needed now is research on fungicides and timing of applications, and first detectors need to be trained to ensure swift identification of soybean rust so that the disease is managed properly. I'm here to ask you that you strongly encourage University of Minnesota to expedite the approval of the university's rabbit response funds, as requested in the soybean rust proposal submitted by the University of Minnesota's plant pathology faculty and wholeheartedly supported by MSGA, Minnesota Soybean Research and Promotion Council, and the Department of Ag. The threat of soybean rust indeed requires a rapid response, and this is the best action we can take at this time. A level 3 containment facility. Included in the Senate bonding bill is $160,000 in funding for a pre-designed phase of a Level 3 containment facility to be located at the University of Minnesota St. Paul campus. The proposed Level 3 addition is needed to allow researchers to conduct studies on exotic plant pathogens such as soybean rust. Minnesota has already established itself as a leader in many areas. This facility would enhance even more the positive partnership and collaboration that already exists between the University of Minnesota and the USDA Agricultural Research Service, Plant Health Inspection Service, and Plant Protection and Quarantine, and the Minnesota Department of Agriculture scientists and staff. I sincerely ask that you and your colleagues in the House support Level 3 pre-design funding provided in the bonding bill. Biodiesel. In 2002, Minnesota became the first state in the nation to enact legislation that requires inclusion of 2% biodiesel in all fuel sold in the state. The 8 million gallons of production capacity, 8 million gallons of biodiesel production capacity conditions will be met and requirement will be effective this summer. Redwood Falls, the Farmers Union Marketing and Processing Association, Pampa Biofuels Incorporated, biodiesel plant is already certified and running at an annual rate of 2.5 million gallons. In Albert Lea, Soymore reports their biodiesel plant construction is ahead of schedule and should be completed by mid-May with an annual capacity of 25 million gallons. In Brewster, Minnesota Soybean Processor report that their 30 million gallon capacity biodiesel plant will be completed by September. I want to thank you for your support of biodiesel. This historic legislation enacted in Minnesota has been used as a model across the United States. Engineering needs of transportation. Minnesota agriculture is currently finding itself in an increasing competitive disadvantage relative to other states for allowing longer vehicle lengths on their roads. Because of this, their cost per unit of shipping commodities, livestock, and other ag products is lower than in Minnesota. MSGA is not asking for an increase in the current weight limit per axle, which increases road wear and tear. We're asking that Minnesota legislature consider keeping the weight per axle the same, but allowing for longer lengths with more axles, allowing for pump trailers, as the case of South Dakota. This is one subtle way for the Minnesota legislature to help Minnesota add value to Minnesota agriculture. The farmland tax basis. Minnesota farmland sales have substantially increased recently. This has been due to reasons well beyond what net farm income can generate from this farmland. These increases are prompting substantial increases in tax basis and therefore substantially increasing tax loads that farmers are paying. We don't have a solution, but we do request the legislature review this to see what can be done to help Minnesota farmers stay competitive. To summarize, the Minnesota Soybean Growers is extremely grateful for the excellent working relationship that we have been nurtured between this committee and the entire state legislature. Minnesota leads the nation in an innovative and progressive agricultural legislation. I believe that by working together, we can find common ground to meet these challenges that face the Minnesota state soybean farmers and also create new opportunities. I have no doubt that we're all up to the task. Again, I would like to thank you for the opportunity to address this committee. Minnesota soybean farmers truly appreciate your strong support. This concludes my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Jakes. Terrific, Drunkie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if this probably isn't place to get into it, but I hope that in the near future, this committee or Mr. Schoenfeld and my friend from Wells, Ron Jacobson, I grew up in Wells, will address the biodiesel. I've been hearing some concerns on infrastructure problems with biodiesel at the terminals and mixing. You know, we put the mandate for biodiesel in, but of course all the terminals where folks pick up diesel fuel are not located within Minnesota. Some are in Canada, some are in North Dakota and Iowa and other places. And I understand, Mr. Schoenfeld, when we did ethanol, we actually gave some money incentives to those distributors to put in the equipment to do the mixing and transporting of ethanol. We have not done that yet with biodiesel. I'm a bit concerned on biodiesel use unless we come up with some sort of solution to that. So hopefully that's a discussion, Mr. Chair and members, to the soybean growers that we can have this session and make sure that we have a way to deliver that product out around the state.
Mr. Chair, one quick comment to that. There have been a number of different issues that have been raised about that. That was true during the ethanol debates, too, I'm sure, for those of those that were involved there. I do have some happy news for you, though, at least in one recent zoning approval meeting, there was some approvals in this last week for additional storage tanks to be built in parts of our state. So I'll talk to you more about that, but that would indicate that somebody's doing some things in some areas at least.
Thank you for mentioning that. That is a concern that has been brought to my attention also. And members, just if you look in your pack, if you don't forget the most important thing here, the reception is Thursday night at Vermont Inn Thunderbird Hotel for the Minnesota Soybean Growers, reception 5:30, food at 6:30. So be there. Okay, with that, thank you, Mr. Jacobson. We'll go to Elmer Riesling. I hope I said that right.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Sean Palmer.
Raceland. From Steele County Fair, the Minnesota Federation of County Fairs is another client that I work with.
Okay.
And one of the things I had to pass on to you before Mr. Raceland starts his presentation is that I met with Mr. Rankin today, who I guess I have known since 1980 when I first sat in your spots. And he asked me to pass something on because he's done such great work of historical referencing here, and that is that we found the original app that created Minnesota's agricultural societies, otherwise known as county fairs for the most part. And it was established in the year 1860. And for any of you that are historians of Minnesota history, it is signed by Speaker of the House Amos Cogswell and President of the Senate Ignatius Donnelly. So some of you may recognize that. And approved by the governor and the Secretary of State, but the governor, Alexander Ramsey. So that tells you something about the long-standing relationship that this committee has had with the association of, or excuse me, with the agricultural societies in this state. I would like to just review for you a little bit and give you some good news because it is now past 2:00, and so I'm told that it is no longer under wraps. But I had discussions, if you may recall, that in the last couple of legislative terms, there were attempts by two different governor administrations to eliminate the funding that is provided to the county ag societies by this legislature, which is amounts to about $369,000 a year, I believe, to help carry on their activities. And it was being proposed both in the Ventura administration and earlier by this one to be eliminated. And there were concerns this year that that was the case as well. And I had been talking to the Commissioner of Agriculture, and he had indicated to me about a month ago that we probably indeed were on the chopping block. But we had a meeting about an hour ago. And we are now told, as of 2:00, I think this information was released from the governor's office in the budget, where the governor has overturned that, decided not to come after any of that fair funding this year. So that's good news for us, which also reduces partially of what we had planned to talk about you prior to 2:00.
Well, we're a little behind schedule here, so that's just fine.
Yeah. But in any case, I'll let Mr. Raceland talk a little bit about the importance of
it. And Mr. Raceland, welcome to the House Ag Committee and the Jerry Schoenfeld Day at the Capitol.
thank you very much. If every day was this good, we're glad he's around. I'm Elmer Raceland, District 1 Director for the Minnesota Federation of County Fairs. The Federation of County Fairs is made up of 9 members from Minnesota, all representing a county fair. On the handout that I gave you on the last page, it does show you where your fairs are located. There are 95 county fairs in Minnesota and only 87 counties, as you know. And so that shocks a lot of people right to begin with. But if you imagine back in 1860 how far it was in St. Louis County to get from fair to fair, you'd probably understand why there are more fairs than there are counties. When Jerry brought up that 1860, I just discovered something in the last 4 months about our fair, the Steele County Fair. And we found some documentation in the Minnesota Historical Society that our first fair was in October of 1860, which is the first year that this body established that. And I won't go into it, but I listed the premiums. And you know, the premiums they paid out in 1860 are about what we pay out today. we haven't gone up much. But the thing that really caught my eye was that the top prize, you could win $6 at the fair if you had the best 6 pair of oxen. And I thought, boy, isn't that ironic? Oxen was a category to be judged on. And the person in the county who built the best wagon and the best butter churn were each $1. So I'm thinking, yeah, we have a close tie-in with Minnesota agriculture and county fairs, and have had ever since this fair became a state. On the French, I just grabbed a copy off our website of our goals, and if you can see, number one is agriculture. Always has been, always will be. Have to be diverse, but it's a number one goal for us. Going on to the second page, on the yellow pages, estimated attendance, and I added this up yesterday from the 2003 statistical report from the Department of Agriculture, estimated attendance, 2,764,000 people attend county fairs in Minnesota. There were a total of 225,093 exhibits at county fairs in the state. The state aid to the county fairs in the 2003 report was $351,710. So we think we're probably a pretty good bargain for what we're doing, especially when you consider the next figure where the total number of 4-H members in Minnesota, I just talked to Brad Rugg yesterday, 28,000 4-H members. And, by the way, growing in many places, which was really encouraging to hear from the last 2 years. You can see where we pay the premiums. Obviously, it used to be a reimbursement program. Now it's called an aid program. But we used to get reimbursed for the premiums. And this is what the fairs pay out in premiums, $936,000. Obviously, the state portion does not meet what we totally give out. But I think the important part here is to look at where does that money go. It goes to 4-H and livestock are the two biggest areas where the fair premium money goes. And in my weird mind, I was sitting there yesterday thinking, why would anyone want to damage county fairs? Because we pay sales tax. In our case, our fair pays about $13,000 in sales tax a year, and we get $8,000 in state aid. So it's a good bargain. You're actually getting money back, and all the vendors that work at the fair and all the things that are paying money into the sales tax of the state of Minnesota, we're actually producing revenue, and we're a good economic development tool in our communities. Fairs in Minnesota had a total income of about $10 million last year. Won't bore you with the last page, but there's some little neat gems there, I thought. I'll look at number two. Fairs advance public knowledge of agriculture, and I think that's as important today with our growing urban population, that we not make people in the urban centers knowledgeable of agriculture and how important it is in our state and how important it is for the fairs. Then I dropped down to number five, which was a rallying poll for us 2 years ago. Fairs are a critical part of the 4-H program, and 4-H is a critical part of the fair program. So, in our goals for this year, there are two things. We really only have two big things that we're after, is to retain or increase our aid. Our last increase was in 1988. And the support of the extension services, especially our relationships with 4-H. Anything we can do to establish that, we're establishing young people into the agricultural areas, as well as the general 4-H areas in our communities and our fairs. And number six, fairs are major venues for community groups and nonprofit organizations to raise awareness of their programs and services. And that brings in the commodity groups. When you go to most fairs, you see the soybean group, you see the Farm Bureau, you see the Farmers Union. And we are all tied in this together, and we feel we're a good educational tool for those good. And last but not least, if you go to any fair, at least our fair when we do a survey, and I think it's probably true of your county fair, 96% of the people eat fruit. And when they're there, they're supporting agriculture by eating it for no other reason at all. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Schoenfeld.
I would like to add one other thing that Ms. Reisman did not mention, and that was that, I kind of laid this out in the detail, a year ago, there was a bill passed by this committee that updated language relative to policy, relative to the agricultural society. At that time, one of the provisions in there dealt with a provision that has been longstanding in this policy for, I guess it goes back to 1927. And what it says, and I just want to read it, I know this is not about getting into specific legislation, but something maybe lay out, and if any of you are interested in this area, we'd like to talk to you. And it's exemption from zoning ordinances. The Minnesota Federation of County Fairs had their annual meeting about 3 weeks ago. And the overwhelming issue that beyond funding that came up at that, and it came up by many, many counties, was the fact that for some reason there have been recently a number of interpretations by cities and counties relative to their zoning ordinances and its influence over the fair. And what I'm talking about is the fact that most of the fairs receive a significant portion of their income from the rental of either the fairgrounds or their buildings or the housing thereof of boats and trailers and cars and things throughout the year. And most of you that have been out there probably know, and maybe probably a number of you have your boats stored at the county fairgrounds in the wintertime. There have been a number of cities that have come in and said, no, you can no longer do that because that is against our zoning ordinances because you're not zoned for commercial application or the like. There is a provision in the statute, and it's about two sentences, so I would like to read it to you, and this is something we'd like to try and deal with. It says that exemption from zoning ordinances, when lands lying within the corporate limits of towns or cities are owned by a county or agricultural society and used for agricultural fair purposes, the lands and the buildings now and hereafter erected are exempt from the zoning, building, and other ordinances of the town or city, provided that no license or permit need to be obtained from nor fee paid to the town or city in connection with the use of the lands. And I've talked with Mr. Rankin about this, and we went back and looked at the annotated statutes and so forth, and this is, I suppose, up for interpretation by lawyers on both sides that might want to argue as to whether the jurisdiction lies with the county agricultural society or with the local city that it is in. The concern here is that as we make budget cuts in these areas, and as you cut local government aid as an example, that has also had a pretty negative impact upon some of the fairs, and the fact that as that was cut, they counties cut back on what they give to the fairs for their operation. This rental income and this kind of thing is very, very important, and the zoning ordinances that are now being interpreted by some cities as saying that no, you can't put cars out there, you can't put storage things out there because you're not zoned that way, is something of great concern to us. And so it is an issue that I will be raising somewhere within this legislature in the future, and just wanted to make you aware of it because it is in within it deals with the section of law that does come through this committee in terms of the County Ag Society statute.
Thank you very much. Yes, Mr. Pennis?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, and the exemption is there. We have to spell it out more for him?
Jerry?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Pennis, the exemption is there, but I guess the question comes in as to it is the interpretation by some cities that exemption only applies during the days of the fair, not for the rest of the year. Now, we don't read it that way.
No.
Representative Pennis?
Mr. Chair, and draw it up so it clears the bell, write it for a preschool age, and we'll get it out.
Okay, I think you've found an author, Mr. Schoenfeld.
I don't know about that, but
I understand.
And I have very fond memories of the county fair, though, so I still have my three white ribbons. Okay, Tom, Appel or April or?
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Schoenfeld.
If I could introduce next, one of the other groups that I work with that isn't directly under the purview of the Ag Committee, but certainly has many pieces of law that go through this committee in which farm business management is required. For instance, with the Rural Finance Administration, RFA, it does require, for instance, in a number of their statutes that farm business management is involved in that. And they do, ag education is provide a longstanding aid to farmers and people across the state in agriculture. We have today from the farm business management and high school instructors, a couple of people. One is Tom Apple, who is a high school instructor, and the other is Del Lacey with the farm business management. And we do have a PowerPoint, if it works. If it doesn't, we have a backup paper system here. So if we could...
Jennifer, you want to see if the PowerPoint works for him here?
Mr. Chairman, I might mention to you that, as you've noted with almost all the groups that have come before you, there are many facets of agriculture that are not necessarily within the limitations of the Ag Policy Committee, affected by transportation, local government, environment, and others. Education certainly is an important part of that as well. There is a proposal that is in the governor's budget to provide for a $3 million funding additionally for farm business management, one of the few proposals that actually increased funds this year in that budget. So with that, Mr. Lacey, if you could show a little briefing of that, because it does affect operations within this committee as well.
Welcome to committee, gentlemen.
Chairman Davids, members of the committee, thank you for the chance to take a few minutes here. I'd just like to go through the slide presentation, talking about the management education programs. The problem that we're looking at, these programs are long-standing programs that represent a major resource, and they're recognized statewide, we believe. They have a unique, special, individualized delivery method that presents a significant financial strain to the six colleges where these programs are located. Why invest here, you might ask? Students in this program have a significant impact on the state's economy. This program, or these programs, reach an important student population that would otherwise be unreached. Key constituents groups support and expect the system to be delivered, or the system to deliver this education for both agriculture and small business industries. If you look at the program scope over the last 5 years, for fiscal year 1999 and fiscal year 2004, you can see the changes that have occurred in the number of students, sites, and faculty during that time. A few comments about the program in general. This is a unique program with respect to design. The delivery of education is at the business site for all of those programs that are part of management education. They focus on business and personal goals, so there's a unique focus for each of the students that are enrolled in the program. The management student, the average age is 44 years. They own or operate a business, typically in a rural community, attend college on a part-time basis due to the business demands or other employment commitments. They're seeking systematic process of education and evaluation that's focused on their business, and they have an educational need that is different from other students in the Minnesota State College and University system. A few comments from some of the students that are enrolled in the program. The first comment really says that the information deals directly with my business. The second item is talking about individualized one-on-one instruction. And the last statement really is looking at a person who comes out to the business and talks about specifics for the farming area in high-stress times. The impact of the program can be stated in some financial comments, I guess. The average student enrolled in farm business management has a contribution of over $400,000 to their community. Totally, if you look at the 4,000 students in the program, that's over $1.6 billion of economic impact. The small business management programs, we had a study of 177 businesses in small business management recently. Over 1,600 full and part-time jobs were noted, 286 new jobs in one given year. Taxes paid were almost $2.5 million in sales tax, and the average business in this group paid $150,000 in wages to their employees. The legislative proposal, as Jerry commented about, we're looking at this total request of $3 million. We're looking at, initially, student support, which directly deals with supporting the tuition that is a tuition subsidy that exists for these students to limit increases in their tuition. Revenue coverage to help support the six to eight colleges that manage these programs statewide. And the statewide collaboration, diverse needs, capacity buildings, building areas are really looking at expanding the programs into unique areas and also working together and doing some new things in those areas in the management programs, whether it deals with statewide meetings or marketing and those types of things.
Mr. Chairman, the other person that's here is with the other end of the Ag Education Group. This is the Farm Business Management. All takes place, many of you may not know, it all takes place through the MINSCU system, the higher education system. Most of you are probably aware of Ag Education programs within your high schools and some of the technical areas, and with this is Mr. Apple with just three slides to talk about about that.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Mr. Chair and committee, thank you for allowing me to be here today. I just have three quick slides. As Jerry said, both Del and I represent the Minnesota Association of Agriculture Educators. That's the education portion of agriculture. It's high school instructors, farm management instructors, and some post-secondary instructors. Our association has approximately 350 educators in the state of Minnesota that belong to this organization. Three quick slides here. The first one, you can take a look at those bullets. This is the amount of high school programs that we have in Minnesota and the number of high school instructors, approximately 240 instructors, looking at about 190 programs. You can look at the students that we've served.
Yep.
The issue that I'm here to kind of speak to you about today is of course, again, funding. Seems to be an interesting topic. What you need to be aware of is that the current funding for high school programs is based on the 2000-2001 old, outdated, taken off the books categorical aid formula from the state of Minnesota. It was shifted to a local levy approved by the school board at that time. That's a very important point that you need to keep in mind. In terms of $2 up there, right now, career and technical education programs in Minnesota, that includes agriculture education plus all the other disciplines, receive approximately $12 million in local levy dollars from local districts. Of that, approximately $4 million comes for agricultural education. So every fall when the school board has to go ahead and go through all their local levies, they levy for health and safety and everything else. Right now, for agricultural education at the high school level, they must also approve that levy. The problem with that is it's tied to the 2000-2001 number. The example I give you there is our local district at Mountain Lake, because the amount of aid we received in 2000-2001, that is the maximum aid that we can receive any time in the future. It's capped at 25% of that year's expenditures. So we are locked in at a fixed dollars for now into the future until we can perhaps address the issue. The main problem with that, it does put a cap on the local levy. It's just a one-liner. There's no leeway for improvement in funds. Any new programs that we start, if you start new programs, if another community decides to establish a high school program, no funds are available because they did not receive funding in 2000-2001. If programs have expanded, as in the case of my situation, those dollars, added dollars and added costs cannot be recouped by the local district. The fixed dollar is what it is. So that kind of goes ahead and hurts those a little bit. And then, of course, we can all talk about inflation in terms of how that has affected schools. So on behalf of the Minnesota Association of Agriculture Educators, we're looking at some farm management, business management things. And then, of course, we're looking at addressing that particular local levy issue.
Thank you, sir.
Are there any questions?
Thank you very much. Representative Hennison Eicher.
Mr. Chair, and just a question on this. This is a separate levy, then, is what they turned it into. It is not like vocational. It's separate, agricultural.
Mr. Chair, to answer the representative's question, this is a separate levy on your levy. So we'll levy for health and safety. Career and technical education went under a name change. So those of you that are familiar with vocational education, same thing. We're playing the name game again.
Yeah.
This is vocational education, now known as career and technical education.
Mr. Chairman, I think the question that Representative Hennison specifically was whether it was a levy only for ag education. That is not the case. It is part of the career and technical
education. That's what I was asking.
But of the $12 million, what a lot of people don't realize is that of the $12 million in that annual levy statewide, $4 million approximately goes to ag programs. So that it is, they are the most significant single user of that
level. Okay, and then I have a follow-up. And at first it was just for, you came back, you had to come back each year, did you not? And then finally last year at...
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Schoenfeld?
That's fine. The original situation was that prior to 2000-2001, it actually was a state appropriation. And then it was switched to the levy, and it had a sunset each year until a year ago, and then that sunset was changed to be a permanent levy. The problem with it is that it was changed to be a permanent levy based upon the 2000-2001 dollar amounts, so that under the permanence of the levy, it never goes up.
Thank you.
Hi, Gerken, we're going to move on. We're pretty close to being on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Penis had the same question I had.
Great minds think alike. Okay, while Bob Zelenka's coming up here, for the next bit of testimony here, I will announce that look at your emails, members. There, the dairy impact study has been emailed to you. You should have that from our last meeting. Okay, Mr. Bob Zelenka, Executive Director, Minnesota Grain and Feed Association. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bob Zelenka, Executive Director of the Minnesota Grain and Feed Association. Mr. Schoenfeld does not represent our association.
Not yet.
Yeah, he's been working on it, but not as of yet.
Mr. Schoenfeld, we got one for you here. No, just kidding.
He knows.
Okay.
The grain elevator industry, I want to just speak briefly about that. I have some handouts for you. What I passed out is just some general information to give you an idea of this industry, a profile of the average grain elevator here in the state of Minnesota. There are 400 grain elevator companies operating out of 600 locations here in the state of Minnesota. It's a large industry that some people are unaware of in terms of its scope. We employ over 12,000 employees statewide. That's directly, not counting indirectly with truckers and others that are influenced by our businesses. We've been adding value to grain for over 125 years in this state. The average elevator handles over 6 million bushels of grain, employs over 14 people annually, or 14 people on average, annual sales volume of about 12 million in grain, about 3 million in farm inputs, and the average feed mill sells over 19,000 tons of feed. And as you can tell, grain elevators and feed mills are a major economic force in rural Minnesota as well as in the rural United States. Grain elevators were the first businesses generally to locate every 9 miles when the railroad stopped. We still have 50% of our members that still lease their land from the railroad going back when they were encouraged to locate on those rail stops every 9 miles. Thus, a lot of communities are 9 miles apart. To this day, we continue to be a major employer, a major taxpayer, and a major reason why a lot of people patronize the small communities and utilize the services in those communities. In your first hearing, Mr. Chairman, you mentioned about the amount of grain going down the river. And I might suggest that the 300 million bushels of grain going down the river, while it does benefit some firms like ADM and Cargill, it also benefits thousands of producers and hundreds of grain elevators in the state who use that resource to add value to the customers that they do business with. Our industry has 125 of the 400 firms in the state are locally owned cooperative grain elevators, and with approximately 150,000 producers, stakeholders, and stockholders of these cooperatives. So when you're looking at rural agribusiness, you're looking at the impact in rural business, we are and have been and will continue to be part of the rural infrastructure in and around the state of Minnesota. Some of the issues that we're looking at, quite honestly, are fees. To us, tax is spelled FEE now, and it's coming to hit us every year. We're watching the Minnesota Department of Agriculture budget again this year. We're looking at some additional fees, perhaps in fertilizer and in our feed industry. We took some hits last year in the grain side. We're also looking at transportation issues, and to follow up on what we brought up by the livestock industry, we have a growing number of our members that are concerned about the untethered growth of the ethanol industry in this state. When you look at 200 million bushels of corn that are going to ethanol currently, and you're looking at expanding that, it does have an impact on some businesses. But all I would suggest is that when you look at expansion and value added, you think about the existing agricultural infrastructure when you look at these issues. And so as it came up in the Senate, and I know it will come up here in the House, these are one of those issues that is easy to overlook, but it certainly does have an impact on the people that I represent. Just quickly, there's a brochure I passed around as well. I'm also executive director of the Midwest Shippers Association. This was some legislation passed by the Minnesota legislature some 4 years ago, created an association to essentially help to promote and advocate and help move the specialty grains grown in this region to end users more directly and efficiently. We have moved over 700 containers of primarily specialty soybeans to markets in areas such as Japan and Taiwan. And I just wanted to bring this to your attention. This is a program that was funded by the legislature for initial startup. It is going fine. The Board of Directors is on the back, and it's an organization that is also, again, managed by the Minnesota Grain and Feed Association, but for producers and processors who are members of this separate association. So this is just kind of a meet and greet. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. I know you're running a little tight on time. If you have any further questions, I can answer them now or later.
Thank you. We'll take one, Representative Pennis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm competing with Jerry Schoenfeld today. In my neck of the woods, we have had a problem with grain buyers and buying grain and not being able to pay off the farmers. And last year we addressed this with increasing the bonds, which would be I don't know how you want to look at it. You buy the bonds. But I don't think that solved the problem, because frankly, when you buy grain, you hold much more than that. Either you're trustworthy or you aren't. I say put them in jail, but we don't have prison room either. But anyway, if you have any ideas, would you let me know? Because that problem, farmers there that have lost six figures in sales of grain are probably going to recoup a little bit of it in the final analysis, and I don't know where the grain vanished to. But, so.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative, when things like that occur, it affects the whole industry adversely. And last year, I think more importantly, the bonding was important, but just by strengthening the financial requirements, helped a lot. We don't allow compilation statements anymore, or the state doesn't, for licensing and bonding. And that has helped a lot to sort of weed out some people who don't have the financial base to participate in this industry. But if I have any further ideas, I will certainly talk.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I would, Mr. Zelenka, I'd like to follow up with that, make an appointment to stop and see me sometime. We had a small elevator go down in Spring Grove, and some folks got stuck, and I've got some ideas on how to correct that. So.
Happy to visit with you.
Thank you
very much.
But, just overall, the industry strong and solid and firm. It's just...
it happens.
Yeah, it happens. Okay, thank you. Rod Jorgensen, Minnesota Ethanol Coalition, and Jerry Seck, Minnesota Ethanol Coalition. Welcome, gentlemen, to the Ag Committee, and please present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Jerry Seck. I'm legislative and legal counsel to the Minnesota Coalition for Ethanol. And Rod Jorgensen was sitting on my left and can tell you about that. But let me just introduce Rod with a couple of comments. I met Rod about 12 years ago. We had an overview hearing about ethanol in the Senate. And this young guy showed up who had introduced himself from Kaysen, Minnesota. He's a young farmer. He had gone to ag school at the University of Minnesota, came back to his parents' farm and took his computer out and said, this won't make it. We can't make a decent living on the farm unless we get into value added, which got him involved in the ethanol movement. Not too long after that, there was a groundbreaking in Claremont for a 10 million gallon plant that took probably 4 or 5 years of hard work to get people to raise the dough to do it. The gym was filled, and I think because some of the other people have had ethanol plants, with 400 or 500 people. There was Senator Wellstone was there, the governor's office, you name it. And these people had been through years of hard work, and it reminded me of the story that you read to your kids and grandkids about the little train, I think I can, I think I can, I know I can, I know I can, I can. And so these people worked hard to get small ethanol plants. The ethanol plant has now gone from 10 million to 15 million to 20 million to 30 million and just got approval from the MPCA to go to 35 million. So these plants are doing well. They're growing and doing a lot of other things. So I'll turn it over to Rod Jorgensen, the president of the Ethanol Coalition of Minnesota, and he can speak for himself.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. My name is Rod Jorgensen. I farm near Kaysen, and I'm one of the 350 shareholders at Elkhorn Ethanol Plant in Claremont. I also serve as the Minnesota Coalition for Ethanol president, which represents 7 producing ethanol plants in Minnesota. On behalf of the ethanol plants and their farmer members, I would like to give you an update on the state of the industry and the initiatives that have helped in making renewable fuels a multi-million dollar industry in Minnesota. First, let me say that we enthusiastically support House File 223, which increases the minimum content of ethanol from 10 to 20%. Let me touch on a few reasons why I feel this bill is good for our plants, our farmers, our community, and our state. This legislation builds on the enormously successful ethanol legislation previous legislatures have put into place. many of you being a part of that legislation. The state put an incentive in place for farmers to organize, raise capital, and construct an ethanol plant. After this was all done, the plants began producing ethanol, which enabled them to receive a producer payment for their investment. While the state's investment has been significant, it is dwarfed by the economic activity that has been created by the industry. Over $500 million of output has been resulted from ethanol plants, creating thousands of good-paying jobs, mainly in rural Minnesota. Our farmer investors have benefited too. Our corn prices have increased because of the value added we have received processing corn into ethanol and distillers' grains. As many of you know, when an area's farm economy prospers, the community benefits too. When farmers have a little extra money, they tend to spend it. Local businesses like banks, machinery dealers, auto dealers, and hardware stores are the beneficiaries of this economic activity. It is my belief that the opportunities that farmers have had because of ethanol have given young farmers an incentive to keep doing something that they love. I know that's the case with me. And don't forget, all corn producers who sell corn have benefited from ethanol plants, even if they are not investors. Corn bids around ethanol plants have increased as plants continue to use more and more corn. Second, the state benefits from ethanol production. While most of our businesses are located in rural Minnesota, we use many vendors from the metropolitan area. At Elkhorn, we utilize engineers and attorneys from the Twin Cities, and many of the contractors who built and expanded our plant came from the metro area. Our state also benefits from cleaner air. Years ago, ethanol was the oxygenate of choice when the Twin Cities was a non-attainment area. Ethanol-blended gasoline quickly brought our state in compliance with the Clean Air Act, and our groundwater wasn't jeopardized like it was in other states. Most importantly, it's homegrown, and that's a huge win for the state. Instead of importing all our oil to be turned into gasoline, we produce more than enough to replace 10% of our fuel needs. And that's economic activity that stays right in the state, buying goods and paying taxes here. When you look at the big picture, one realizes that ethanol needs to be a part of our energy needs. We have a finite amount of fossil fuels. While energy demands continue to grow around the world, global supplies in areas like Mexico have plateaued and in other areas are receding as they are in the North Sea. More and more of our nation's energy will come from the Middle East, an area I would call unstable at best. With all that said, we continue to produce more corn crops. Prices have remained relatively stagnant and ethanol production continues to rise. In 2004, the U.S. produced 3.7 billion gallons of ethanol. Next year, we're set to produce 4.4 billion gallons. In a couple of years, Minnesota production will increase to over 600 million gallons of ethanol. While some of that increase is coming from existing plant expansion, much of the increase will come from new plant expansion. All these new plants participate in the JobZ program designed to encourage economic development. Plants in Atwater, Granite Falls, and Lake Crystal have already broken ground, and as you have heard, another in Heron Lake is in the permitting process. These plants, joined with existing production, will produce over three times the statutory goal of 220 million gallons that was put in place back in 1995. Why then are we outsourcing our needs when we have the ability to produce our own fuel right here? House File 223 answers that question head on, and again, we fully support it. Our organization also supports the full funding of ethanol plants that are part of the producer payment program. If this is not possible, we had asked that the amount reduced would be reinstated when the plants are near the end of their eligibility. And what was just mentioned in testimony prior to this, I think I'd like to address, and that's with the grain elevators. I know in our situation, we have a grain elevator that is right beside our plant. Many of the people involved in the plant buy corn from that elevator, and so although they're not shipping that corn down the road, they're still merchandising those same bushels. It's just that they're getting used locally and not going to Winona. The second point I would make that if a farmer is prospering, which ethanol plants have helped them do, they have more money to spend at elevators buying fertilizers and other inputs. So I think that offsets that concern. once again, thank you for helping keep Minnesota the leader in renewable fuels. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Okay, next we have Gene Sandbanger from the Minnesota Corn Growers Association.
Sandbanger.
Sandbanger.
That's a long story, Doug.
Okay, I'm...
I don't think we have time for that one.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of this committee. My name is Gene Sandiger, and along with my brother, I operate a farm near Hills, Minnesota. And Hills, Minnesota is the last town in the state way over by Sioux Falls, South Dakota. And so I'm fortunate because I get the opportunity to see policy in three states. And years ago, I wanted to, you know, kind of get annexed to South Dakota. But because of the leadership here, I've changed my mind. I want to stay in Minnesota, and we've got good vision, and we got a lot of good things going for us. Right, Doug? Okay. I currently serve as the president of the Minnesota Corn Growers Association, and this is an organization with about 5,000 members. We're committed in creating opportunities for increased profitability for corn farmers. And in 2004, we produced about a billion bushels of corn, okay? And that was in despite of an early frost, cold weather, you know, lack of heat units, and a frost in August. Despite dire predictions by some, there continues to be enough corn to meet demand. Expanding ethanol production is often cited as potentially tightening corn supplies. The fact is that corn yields have increased right along with the ethanol production, and corn is available at prices similar to before the ethanol period. Now, to give you an example of that billion bushels, a little more than half goes to livestock production, 160 million goes into ethanol production, and the other 300 million gets exported out of the state. Now, the concern I have is we are buying oil to produce products, and we are using the energy, we are amplifying the energy. And you're going to get posed with this question a number of times during this session, especially when we start talking about ethanol. But the latest data from USDA indicates that for every unit of energy going into ethanol production, that includes the production process, it includes the transportation and all the rest of the energy input into corn production and the process itself, we get back 1.67. So 67% more energy than what we put in it. So if we are a state that is importing oil, and if we don't put it through the greenhouse, the solar panel, to produce ethanol, we are making a big mistake. Now, I also sit on National Corn Growers Association, and we're involved with a lot of WTO compliance. We're worried about NAFTA. We are also sitting on the biotech. And as we look for uses of corn, and as we look at our dependence on foreign oil, we have to keep this potential in mind. And it is a privilege, being from Minnesota, and being able to brag about what our predecessors did and putting 10% in our gas tanks. They are amazed that we're even considering the 20%, but looking at the alternatives, I think we're doing the smart thing. As far as Minnesota livestock, it's an important part of our economy. It's the largest market for Minnesota corn. Currently, the segments of the livestock industry most reliant on corn are pork and poultry. They're stable, they are healthy industries. However, the dairy sector, which is a little less dependent on corn, has the high potential to take advantage of dried distillers grain, which is produced in our ethanol plants. It continues to decline in our state, and that is one of our concerns as corn growers. Clearly, there are factors beyond corn supplies that need to be addressed if we are to regain market share in milk production and maintain our place among the leaders in U.S. pork and poultry production. We're happy to see others enjoying us in water, improving water quality. Agriculture is consistently evolving. Back in the days when my father farmed, and he was considered by our standards an organic farmer. As a little boy, I was appalled at some of the erosion, some of the water quality issues in his livestock production. And I look at the advances that we've made in agriculture today and say we have done a fantastic job. It's not just in our state, but if I look at where we are compared to the rest of the world, in Minnesota, I believe we're doing an excellent job. Agriculture's significant contribution to our economy depends on continued access to safe and effective crop protection products. Minnesotans need to understand that herbicides are thoroughly and intensively tested for safety and applicators, including farmers like myself, who in the next few weeks I have to get my certification, are extensively trained and certified. These are professionals whose livelihood depends on exercising care and caution to minimize environmental risk. I cannot afford to spend money on a pesticide and over-apply it. I will be out of business. I also, as a little boy, used to look at the chemicals my father used, and today I'm happy to say that the chemicals are 500 to 1,000 times safer than they were during that age. Finally, I'd like to stress again that the renewable fuel industry, particularly dry mill ethanol production, has become an invaluable economic stabilizer in rural Minnesota. We are pleased to see the governor take a leadership role in expanding renewable fuels potential to displace petroleum fuels. We are heavily subsidized, the potential to displace petroleum fuels. They are heavily subsidized and have significantly higher negative environmental impact on ethanol. Let's produce our energy here. Let's be less dependent on foreign oil, and we can do this in an environmentally clean way. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members, for your time, and we hope to visit with you in the future.
Thank you, Mr. Sandiger. Representative Johnson and Blaine. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Sandiger, your good numbers on the conversion ratios are music to the ears of all of us who are very interested in supporting ethanol. Just last week, I had somebody in my office who was bringing up the old ratios and expressing concern about the loss of energy, and I was happy to tell her, not having the numbers, that there was, in fact, a gain in energy. And if you're able to supply those numbers, I will get them to this constituent who needs to know the good news about third-generation ethanol production.
Mr. Chairman, can I respond? Thank you, Congresswoman. It is, you know, USDA, very sophisticated department that did the analysis. It reviewed some of the preliminary or the studies before, and this agency was able to come in and analyze how they accumulated their data. And I'm sorry that it has misled a lot of people to believing that this is not energy efficient. It is going to continue, I assure you, to get better as we produce more corn. In fact, the genomics that we're working on a national level, being able to map that genetic background, doubling and tripling our production is a reality. It's not a dream. It is a reality. And as we do this, I think we got to keep this in mind.
Representative Blaine?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Very quickly, Mr. Sandiger and Mr. Jacobson, I see, is still here, too. I just want to take the opportunity to say thank you on behalf of those interested in livestock production here in the state for the effort that's been put forth by your organization, the corn growers and the soybean growers in the state, to draw attention to the importance of animal agriculture here in the state and the willingness to put that message out onto the media airwaves, because I think it is hitting home with a lot of people, and I think there's a lot of good information that's being shared out there with those who don't know any better. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Blaine. Okay, next, thank you, Mr. Sandiger. Next, Steve Ladley, Minnesota Ethanol Producers Association. Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Steve Ladley. I'm here representing the Minnesota Ethanol Producers Association, and I'm here to speak in favor of the of moving from the 10% ethanol blend to the 20% ethanol blend in the state and our fuel supplies. A little bit about my background. I grew up in the farm in southern Minnesota, attended the U of M, 28 years in the farm supply business, raised a family and farm part-time, and currently I am farming full-time. I made my first investment in the ethanol business back in about 1998 when I invested in a plant near Albert Lea called Exol. I've also recently raised capital and am on the board of directors of Northstar Ethanol LLC being constructed near Lake Crystal, and production there will start early in the summer of this year. If we look at renewable fuels, if we really break it down to something real simple, what is it? Well, it's really taking the energy that's collected from the sun every summer and turning it into a form that we can use in our vehicles. That's really all it is. And the nice thing about it is it happens year after year after year. It has been my experience that ethanol has made a difference to the farm families all over Minnesota, and I want to give you a few personal examples that I'm more familiar with. Exol near Albert Lea has 500 farm family investors. In 1998, they invested $22 million in that plant. Then they voted to expand it and spent another $28 million. And recently, they just again voted to update and make the plant even more efficient, and they're going to spend another $24 million for a total of over $75 million being spent at that plant alone. Northstar Ethanol near Lake Crystal, being currently constructed, is a $65 million plant with 325 investors and will grind 17 million bushels of corn. Statewide, we have thousands of farm family investors in this relatively new industry. Price of corn around an ethanol plant generally improves from 7 to 15 cents per bushel. That's $7 to $21 an acre. So it's very significant, not only for the people that have invested in the ethanol business, but also for every other grower, corn grower in the area. It's also important to know that it's an effective hedge for a corn grower, because when the price of corn is high, they can make money growing corn. When the price of corn is low as it is today, they can actually make some money growing ethanol, making them more financially stable. DDGs are created from the process, because only the starch is used, but the DDGs are high quality, high protein animal feed that is continually opening new markets all across the country. If we look at the industry, it's currently expanding at a rate of 33 to 35% per year. There's 3.7 billion gallons a year produced. Currently in Minnesota, we're looking at 400 million gallons. Approximately 250 gallons are needed for Minnesota to go from the 10 to 20% blend. Four facilities are under construction that we talked about already. That added production from those four facilities at Heron Lake, Lake Crystal, Granite Falls, and Atwater will be close to 190 to 200 million bushels. If you look at each individual ethanol plant, they create 40 new full-time jobs. What that means is 40 families stay or move to rural America. And there's scores of indirect jobs that are created in other businesses, and all other types of industries are enhanced, whether it be the transportation, grain handling, rural electric co-ops, banks, restaurants, service stations, railroads, tire stores. I got to put a plug in for Dan Dorman. And the list goes on. But production of ethanol has already made a difference in the main streets of Benson, Preston, Laverne, Albert Lea, Winnebago, Buffalo Lake, Morris, Marshall, Bingham Lake, Winthrop, and Claremont. And soon will make a difference at Heron Lake, Atwater, Lake Crystal, and Granite Falls, and the surrounding areas. By the middle of next year, the production capacity in Minnesota will be close to 600 million gallons, and $750 million will have been invested. The process is continually becoming more efficient. We've moved from 2.5 to 2.6 to 2.8 to 2.9, and I saw 1 month last year we had production of 2.99 gallons of ethanol per bushel of corn. So we're continually getting more efficient at producing a clean, renewable energy. All the products that go into the process are natural. We're using yeast and corn and enzymes. and all the products come out are clean products, non-polluting, and readily usable. Technology is continually increasing output. Today, there's plants that were designed to do 12 million gallons of production a year. Those same plants are now doing 20 to 22 million gallons a year. Some plants were built to do 40 million, and those plants are doing over 50 million gallons to date. This industry has an excellent track record since 1995 and 96, and the foundation is in place for an even more efficient future. Designs are evolving, technologies are enhancing the fermentation process, engineering creates efficiencies, management is continually improving, and marketing is developing new uses and expanding markets. This industry makes good sense, good business sense for now, and even more so for our future generations. Cars running cleaner, we got less carbon monoxide. It's good for our air, it's good for our water, it's good for the entire economy of Minnesota, and it's good for our national security. The Minnesota legislature was a catalyst that jump-started the renewable fuel industry in Minnesota. The industry has not let you down. The farmer investors and entrepreneurs have reacted as you wanted them to react. The 10% mandate and the producer payments had a big part in that success. And according to the state auditor's office, Minnesotans got a 16-to-1 return on the invested dollars for the producer payments. Now you must decide once again whether you will act as a catalyst as we look at the E20. But this time, there will be no added producer payments. The industry is established. The farmers, the bankers, the investors, and the families across Minnesota will perform as you direct. Be the catalyst once again. Be the first state to move to 20% renewable fuels in a gas supply. As I attended some of the national conferences over the last couple of years, some of the comments that are made is when they talk about the Minnesota model and look at what Minnesota has done. And the decisions that you make here in the Minnesota legislature, I believe, will once again lead the nation in regards to renewable energy. We can overcome the obstacles, because the obstacles, I don't believe, are too great. But it's always a bit harder to be the first, but it's also more rewarding. I believe it's time to lead, and it's time for our Minnesota to be the catalyst once again. Those are my comments. Any questions?
Okay, thank you, sir. Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. And finally, we have today Mark Knisley, CEO of Farm Credit Services Minnesota Valley, and Greg Johns, farmer and board member. Welcome to the committee. From Grove City. Fine city. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Great pronunciation, by the way. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I'm here today. I'm Mark Knisley, President and CEO of Farm Credit Services of Minnesota Valley, one of the farm credit entities serving the state of Minnesota. We're here today representing the farm credit system that serves the state of Minnesota. There are four farmer-owned cooperative associations with 32 branch offices in Minnesota. They consist of Farm Credit Services of Minnesota Valley, which is headquartered out of Wilmer, Ag Country Farm Credit Services, headquartered out of Fargo, FCS of Grand Forks, obviously headquartered out of Grand Forks, and AgStar Financial Services. We're also fortunate in this state to have our wholesale bank located here in St. Paul, which is AgriBank. We're part of a nationwide network created in 1916. We represent and provide financial services and products to nearly 23,000 producers in the state of Minnesota. Everything from small, young, beginning farmers to large agribusinesses and rural residents. I believe we've distributed a brochure with some of the statistics that I'll be referencing in my talk today. We currently have about $2.75 billion in loan assets outstanding in Minnesota. Our services to rural America and rural Minnesota and agriculture include real estate loans, farm operating and production credit loans, real estate home mortgage loans in communities under 2,500, credit life and crop insurance, various types of leasing products, as well as record keeping, business planning, and tax management services. Our charter is limited. We are asked the question periodically whether we're a bank. We do not do any depository services, so our charter is limited to the to providing services to farmers and agribusinesses in rural America. We've been very active at the state capitol for the past 20 years. I should mention that we're represented by John Appitz and the lobbying team at Meserly and Kramer, who's here on a day-to-day basis representing the Farm Credit System. We have an extensive grassroots network that includes our customers and directors in the state. We've included our 2005 legislative materials in the handout. And next week, I believe, is our 14th annual legislative reception for agriculture, for the various rural committees and agricultural committees, and that will be held here in St. Paul next week. And I believe you've received an invitation for that already. Our top legislative priorities for 2005 include taking action on the recommendations of the Governor's Task Force on Animal Agriculture, implementation of the stakeholders' recommendations for the Impaired Waters Initiative, and reauthorization of the Electronic Real Estate Recording Task Force to complete the implementation of that program. I'd also like to mention, again, on the statistics that were distributed, we have loans outstanding to young and beginning farmers of nearly $1 billion in this state. They total nearly 18,000 loans. We also have over 23,000 loans to small farmers and small producers. The employee base of the Farm Credit System in the state of Minnesota is 836, which would include the AgriBank staff. And as I mentioned earlier, we have 32 offices located in the various rural communities. It's a great honor working for a farmer-owned cooperative. We have the opportunity to do things that a lot of companies don't have an opportunity to do, which is have our customers also be our stockholders. And we take that obligation very seriously. A number of the farm credits in the state of Minnesota have patronage programs where we're distributing earnings after tax back to our patrons, and we're very proud of the system that we have established in this state and the service that we provide to rural America. With that, Mr. Chairman, I would be glad to entertain any questions. Thank you for the opportunity for letting us present to your committee today, and we would also be available at any time in the future for any follow-up questions as well.
And I'm sure you'll be following things, and you've got some great information on your legislative priorities. Any questions for the gentleman? Representative Trimba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you give me an idea of what is the average size of a dairy herd that you would loan out money to?
Mr. Nicely?
Representative, I don't have the statistics for all of the associations. I could only speak on behalf of our association, which serves a 10-county area in the upper Minnesota River Valley, starting with Meeker, Candy, Ojai, Redwood, and Redwood and Renville counties, going to the west, South Dakota. I would say that the average dairy size, and I may even ask my board member here to chime in on this, since he's also involved in the Minnesota Milk Producers Association. I would guess that the average size of our dairies in western Minnesota are probably in that 50 to 75 cow range, somewhere in there.
Okay, and Mr. Chair, thank you. What is the average amount of money that you would loan to them?
Well, every operation is unique, and to offer a guess on what that might be in a general statement would be inappropriate for me to try and speculate on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you very much, gentlemen. And with that, we will adjourn until tomorrow at 2:30. Good government all the time. We are adjourned.